Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Book Cave. This is Rick Crofton.
And Art Sippo.
And today we have a special little show. We had Art doing a little trip over to, what's it, Seattle?
That's correct.
It was FarmerCon, wasn't it?
That's right. We had the FarmerCon, and this was in conjunction with the Locust Magazine Awards Banquet, which is held about the same time every year in the Seattle area.
Now, is this the first year that we had Philip and Faye Farmer on it?
No. Well, let me give you a little background on the whole FarmerCon thing. Phil Farmer, as you know, passed away a couple of years ago, and his wife, he died in February back in 2008, and his wife followed. Shortly, 2009. And his wife died 4 months later in June. Prior to his death, Phil had made contact with several fans, some of whom had lived in the area of Peoria where he lived, and folks who had been admirers of his work and had done some things online and in magazines. And 5 years ago, in 2005, Phil invited this small group of folks to come out and visit him at his house over the summer, and they had an informal convention, if you will, where they got to sit and talk to Phil and discuss his work. The original group that had congregated around Phil was Mike Croteau, who actually lives up in the Peoria area, Chris Carey, who works in the publishing business up in the Washington State area, Paul Spiteri, who is from England. He's actually of Maltese extraction. We've had Paul on the show. He talked about Ian Banks, if you remember.
Yeah.
Yep. And then, of course, the indubitable Wynn Eckert. Wynn is an attorney from Denver who has done an awful lot for Wold Newton studies. He runs the Wold Newton Universe website, probably the largest one on the net, and he has published quite a bit in this area, both fiction and nonfiction. And there were also some other folks who joined in. John Small came from Oklahoma. He's a newspaper man down there. We had Hans Kiso and his wife Hani, who come from Denmark, of all places. And these folks had congregated there at Phil's place for the first con. After that, they made it a plan to come every year to see him. I was invited to the what they called FarmerCon 90, which was the third con. This was celebrating Phil's 90th birthday. And at that time, he had just had another stroke. He was still quite a bit debilitated. But I did have the opportunity to meet him in person. And I spent the evening, we went out to a restaurant, and I spent the evening talking to his lovely wife, Betty, who was very charming and very intelligent. You know, it's very obvious why she and Phil lasted together so long. They were married for 60 years. And they were always very close to each other. They went to cons together. They were called the power couple of science fiction back in the 1970s and 80s. Anyway, the con has been by special invitation. I was very privileged that they included me. I had done some Wold Newton stuff, and I'd discussed things with Wynn Eckert online for years, and I'd known Wynn over that time, so he extended to me that invitation, and it was wonderful to meet Phil. Unfortunately, Phil passed away the following year, and we did not have him with us for last year's con. Betty was with us, but she was too ill to really participate. And so we actually interacted with Phil's grandchildren and his son. We had a marvelous time. They were very nice, coming and talking with us and extending us courtesies and allowing us to see some of the material. Well, the reason why I bring all this up is that in those last few years, when the first con happened, Mike Croteau and the boys were talking with Phil, and he mentioned what has come to be known as the Magic Filing Cabinet. And in the Magic Filing Cabinet, Phil put all kinds of ideas, outlines, unsold material, forgotten material, letters. There's a whole series of things in there that were from his most creative period, things that he had either not followed up on or for one reason or another had not gotten the market for. So the Magic Filing Cabinet was chock full of material. And over the last several years, this group of four guys has worked hard to try and get some of that unpublished material published. Some of this was material that had been published in small journals elsewhere. Some of this has been novels that Phil had done in the past that either had been published or were held in abeyance because they were a little bit ahead of their time in some way. It's interesting that Phil began his career trying to be a mainstream novelist, and he always was dealing with some very, he always was dealing with social issues. The issues having to do with sex were very important to Phil, and, an honest portrayal and understanding of human sexuality. But also, he dealt with questions having to do with race, and sometimes interracial sexuality. This is not only in his attempts at mainstream books, but also in some of his science fiction novels. The thing that always amazes me is that what little I know of Phil, having met his wife, having met him, seen his house, and seen home movies and things of him, he seemed to be a rather conventional man. He was not really a revolutionary. He was not really a wacko. He had a wonderful marriage. He raised his kids very well. Everybody thought very fondly of him. He was a good fellow, and people liked him in Peoria. They were sometimes a little surprised at the things he wrote, knowing him. But the Magic Filing Cabinet has been the source of a lot of material that has been published recently by Subterranean Press. We have Pearls from Peoria, The Best of Jose Farmer. We recently had an anthology, The Other in the Mirror. They published an ecological novel, The Bottomless Pit, which Phil had not published. He had written this in the 1970s. It needed a little bit of editing and cleaning up because it hadn't had the final polish, and that's what the boys had done. They did an excellent job with it, and it's kind of a very timely novel considering what's going on in the Gulf right now. So this is a story that I think is worth people reading. In any case, there were several little fragments that were there. Some of them were more complete than others, of works that Phil had been in the process of writing, because he was a typical writer of the 1970s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s, where he was constantly churning out something. He always had an idea, he always had a project in the fire, and he was writing sometimes several stories at the same time, and then he would shift gears and work completely on this story to finish it up and then go back to another one, and some of his stories got left in abeyance for many years. There were three novels that he had which were unpublished that he had not actually finished. One was a Western novel. There was one that was an erotic mystery involving Patricia Savage, Patricia Wildman, let me get this right, the daughter of James Clark Wildman, who was allegedly the real Doc Savage, according to Phil's Doc Savage Apocalyptic Life, the biography he wrote of Doc Savage. And there was another story, The Song of Kwasan, which was the third volume in the series that had started with Haddon of Opar and Flight from Opar. These were stories that took place in ancient Africa about 10,000 years ago, and it was his attempt to explain the various ancient civilizations that had come to exist in the Tarzan stories in Africa, where they came from, and, you know, whether they had come from Atlantis or from some other kingdom, and Phil, with his inimitable style, also worked in there some philological stuff. He was a he was interested in language and in philology, and he developed complex linguistic puzzles and actual languages for these different stories happening in the ancient past. He was very familiar with Indo-European languages. He had studied these apparently in college. And he had developed his own non-Indo-European language for the Opar, and the series which would have completed it, is focused on Kokarsa. Kokarsa is the technical name for the empire that he's talking about. And we'll, figure on a character named Kwasan, who was a character in, Flight from Opar. It is actually the culmination of that storyline. And it brings some of the plot elements together and gives us some plotting into the future, which is going to eventually end up in some of the stories for H. Rider Haggard and for Edgar Rice Burroughs. And of the these three novels were very important. The Pemberley House novel, which was finished by Wynne Eckert and was published last year, kind of brings the Doc Wildman family tree up to date. It gives us an idea of who's related to whom. It also has crossovers with multiple Will Newton characters. Wynne does a very good job with that. There is a large amount of original prose in there from Phil himself, but Wynne had to go in there and do his own writing for some of the important parts. And in fact, the ending is a very exciting action sequence that Wynne did, which is very smooth and very nicely done. Phil was a little choppy, I think, on some of the action sequences, and Wynne did him justice. He smoothed it out. He kept the flavor of Phil's storyline, but he really did a good job there, and he made a good contribution to making the denouement interesting and to really make it a very good book. Chris Carey is the one who is doing Song of Kwasan, and Chris had completed the book 2 years ago, and he's been looking for a publisher and has not gotten one yet. But when I went up to see them at the PharmaCon this year, he was able to tell me that there are negotiations in the works, and so we may have an announcement about publication sometime in the next year, hopefully sooner. They're in negotiations now, so he couldn't really tell me much more than this. I will say that I am very excited about this because the last story, the Flight from Opar story by Phil Farmer, was written more than 30 years ago. I think it was back in 77 or so. And so it's been 30 years, and I have been waiting for the sequel to that story. I really enjoyed both Haddon and Flight. Haddon of Ancient Opar and Flight from Opar. They were excellent stories, and I'm really looking forward to this third story, which hopefully will pull together some of these other elements. I will say last year, Chris allowed me to read the first two chapters of the story, and he did a marvelous job. He had to work on the first chapter because Phil had started some things in midstream, and that first chapter was really Chris's, and it carried over very well, and I'm really looking forward to it. This is a book I've been waiting for over 30 years.
Well, Art, when I had him on before, they said something about Time's Last Gift was kind of a prequel to the two.
Yes, Time's Last Gift is, and you really in Time's Last Gift, this is a story that you have to be pretty savvy to understand what's going on with it. The basic storyline in Time's Last Gift is that sometime in the end of the 21st century, time travelers go back 15,000 years into the past, and what they're doing there is, of course, trying to discover the roots of culture. They're trying to see how different ethnic groups migrated in Africa and other places, and in particular, they're looking for the source of the Indo-European language. This is, of course, the Holy Grail in linguistics. Trying to figure out how the different languages evolve from one group to another. And Phil does a very nice job in the story. It's an exciting story about these people going back into the past and they encounter the Kokarsa culture for the first time. And they interact with, different people in the past, and you discover what Phil's solution is to the question of the origin of the Indo-European language. He proposes that in the story. So that's a pretty good technical feat, linguistically. But anyway, the leader of this group is one John Gribbertson. And Gribbertson, in the end of the story, when people are planning to go back, Gribbertson stays. And we discover that, in fact, Gribbertson is actually an alias for another person entirely. A person who had been born in the late 19th century, abandoned in Africa, and raised as a feral child with a group of apes.
Okay.
Now, because he did not have license to use the name Tarzan, Phil Farmer could not identify Gribbertson with Tarzan, but those of us who were Tarzan fans will recognize this. And this character, named Gribbertson, in the end of the story, he stays behind, and I don't want to give away any more secrets of the story. I've already given away quite a bit. But he lives on. He has been given immortality at one time by a grateful sorcerer. And Grimson intends to live out his life from 15,000 years in the past right up until the present. And that is really where the story ends. There's a little more to the ending of the story there, but I will say that the Gribbertson character then becomes what will be known in the Opar stories that have been published and in Song of Kwasan as Sahindar, the gray-eyed god, who wanders through the ancient world doing various deeds. And
two versions of Time's Last Gift.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one, because they tell me about that, and I've got both versions now. You know, one has a lot more to the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Phil Farmer had, he appended some material onto the end of the later edition to explain this a little bit more and to trace Gribbertson's life afterwards up until the present time. And there's some things in there I don't want to give away because I want people to read the story and to enjoy it. But, that was Phil Farmer's great gift in this, so to speak, is that he now has projected his feral hero, Tarzan, back into the ancient past, and Tarzan is present throughout history and is a witness to the development of civilization from its very beginning, from the decline of Kokarsa to the rise of the civilization in the Middle East and in other parts of the world. And that's an important part of the whole Kwasan storyline as you run into Sahindar a couple of times. In fact, you do run into Sahindar very early in the new book. This brings up a point. The book Time's Last Gift has been out of print for almost 20 years now, actually a little more than that. And one of the things that they were talking about at the FarmerCon were other books from Phil's corpus that we would like to see reprinted. Now, Phil's got a lot of stuff everybody wants to see reprinted. We are very lucky at this time that all of his Riverworld series are being reprinted in large trade paperbacks. The first volume is out, which includes the first two stories, To Your Scattered Bodies Go and The Fabulous Riverboat. That's being published as one volume. They were the shortest of the novels. There are three more novels in the series that are being published individually, and these are, for anybody who has not read them, the Riverworld series was, in my opinion, was my favorite of Phil's series. In this story, people who had died up until 1983, nobody after 1983 is included, are all resurrected naked on the shores of a river surrounding a world that is a little bit larger than the Earth. The river is a continuous ribbon that has high cliff walls that are virtually unclimbable in between. The population of this world is about 36 billion humans and proto-humans and near humans. So there are, it includes Neanderthals, it includes some unknown species called the Titanotheres that are, 8 feet tall and weigh 800 pounds, and some other types of characters. But every human being who had ever lived, up to and died up until 1983 was included, along the banks of the river. And so this gave Phil an opportunity to mix up different heroic and villainous characters from throughout history and to show how they interacted. The hero of this sequence was Richard Francis Burton. Now, most people don't know who Richard Francis Burton is. The first thing that comes to mind is the Welsh actor who had married Elizabeth Taylor.
Right.
But, you know, that's what I thought initially. But as I read the story, I found out that Richard Francis Burton was a British explorer. He had been in the British Army in India. And while he was there, he had a penchant for languages. He learned several different languages in India, including Arabic. And he was able to pass himself off using disguises as coming from different ethnic groups. He actually was the first Westerner to successfully go on the Hajj, which is the pilgrimage that Muslim men take once in their lifetime to Mecca, which is forbidden to non-Muslims. He did this, and he came back and wrote about it in a magazine in Britain, which raised all kinds of ire among the Muslims. But he was also an adventurer. He went to different parts of the world. He discovered the source of the Nile River. Among other things, he also was the man who translated the Kama Sutra from Sanskrit into English. The Kama Sutra, of course, being the Indian manual of sexual pleasure that talks about various different techniques and positions and such. Burton died in Trieste, which at that time was a part of Italy, and at that time his wife, who was a very simple and a conventional person, burned his notes, which is very sad because he was working on translations of other books from these other languages, and it's a very sad thing that we lost all that information. But Burton is another one of those characters like Richard Henry Savage, who was larger than life. He was a polymath. He did many things. He was like a Doc Savage character, if you will, an adventurer. And so Burton was a very interesting figure. There recently has been a novel written in Germany about his adventures called The Collector of Worlds, which I would highly recommend. It was published about a year ago, and it discusses Richard Francis Burton's experiences in India, what he did on the Hajj, and other things later on in his life. And he's an interesting character. He's really worth reading about. So anyway, that's what the river world is. And the river world is a mysterious place. They don't know why they're here. They don't know how they got here. They are provided with food, but they don't understand what they're supposed to do. And this is the mystery that Phil carries through for 5 volumes, trying to solve the mystery of who built the river world and why they built the river world and why everybody's here. And all of that is really answered in the last couple of novels. But they're very much fun stories. Phil shows off his knowledge of history, and he, of course, as one of the things that Phil Farmer does best is correcting the errors of history, showing how certain assumptions that people had made about historical characters were not true. I should state, since I'm living here in St. Louis, one of his other major protagonists is Sam Clemens, better known as Mark Twain. And it's Sam Clemens who builds the fabulous riverboat. And, his adventures are also very, very important to the storyline. And there's aliens involved. There's all kinds of things on the river. So by all means, I would encourage folks, they're reprinting these books. If you have not read them, get that first volume that has the 2 first novels in it, and you'll get hooked. And I remember in the 1970s, I just couldn't wait until each new volume was printed. Okay, so anyway, new books are, there are books that fills that we would like to see coming back into print. I really got off on a tangent there. Well, we discussed it, and the discussion we had a consensus amongst ourselves from the PharmaCon group on the three books that we thought should be considered for publication. And we have a whole series of books we want, but these three we thought were on top of the list. And Time's Last Gift is one of them. Time's Last Gift, as you say, has got two different versions, and definitely we would like to have a definitive version published that would include all the material that was in the second version. The other book that we wanted to get published, which is a critically important book, is Doc Savage, His Apocalyptic Light. This was Phil Farmer's biography of Doc Savage that was done in 1972. Now,
it's been reprinted a few times.
It has been, and in each reprint, it was different. Phil changed the chronology in the back of the book, and the initial printing was in 72. There was a paperback version that came out in 1975 in conjunction with the movie. In that book, Phil went and revised the chronology, and that was the one that was published by Bantam. After that, Phil went back and republished it again with Playboy in 1980. In fact, Playboy Press republished A Feast Unknown at that time. They republished Tarzan Alive, which, by the way, has not really had any alterations in its various editions. But when they republished Doc Savage Apocalyptic Life, there was some alterations to the text, as I understand it, and a new chronology. And then, shortly thereafter, Apocalyptic Life was published in England under Panther. And the Panther Press edition is the last one and has the most number of changes, actual changes in the text and an index in the back, which none of the other editions had. So, the boys are very conscious of the fact that the 80th anniversary of Doc Savage is coming up in 2013. It'll be 80 years since the character was put on the stands. And it is their hope to have Doc Savage as Apocalyptic Life published in a definitive critical edition for the year 2013, hopefully in the year 2013. For the 80th anniversary. And if they do this, of course, they're going to get some new material put in. There'll be forewords and afterwards. They'll do pretty much the same thing that Win Eckert had done when he edited the Tarzan Alive edition for Bison Press. You know, at the moment, we do not know if Bison Press is going to be interested in doing Doc Savage. The boys doubted it because Bison seems to be concentrating on Edgar Rice Burroughs, and that was the reason why they liked Tarzan Alive. But the intention is to try and get a version that will be similar, so the two of them can, similar in size and in design, so the two of them can sit together on the shelf. The third book that they wanted to republish was The Other Log of Phileas Fogg. This was a parallel story that goes along with Jules Verne's story Around the World in 80 Days. And in this, there's a lot of Walt Newton material. We not only hear about Phileas Fogg, we also learn about the Capellan and Eridanian civilizations. These are extraterrestrial civilizations that have been influencing Earth history. Captain Nemo is part of this. Professor Moriarty is part of this. And there are other characters that are brought in. This was a delightful story, and it was very interesting to me that I had read Around the World in 80 Days just about 6 months before that book came out. So I was really primed. I knew exactly what the storyline was, and I was able to fill in the details. This is another story that is very important in Walt Newton studies. In the original edition, it included an essay by Phil Farmer where he tries to identify Captain Nemo in the storyline of the Walt Newton universe. So those are the three books that they would like to see republished sometime soon. As a Doc Savage fan, I am absolutely enthralled that they're going to try and get Apocalyptic Life out in a critical edition with all the new material and with additional material by Wynn. I think that's going to be an excellent book. You know, I have about 5 copies of it. I have each a copy of each of the editions. I don't think I have the Panther edition of all things. I never did get that, but I do have copies of the others. And there are still other books that need to come out again, other books that would be of interest to our pulp folks. For example, we need to get a new edition of A Feast Unknown. This is something interesting, something that none of us knew about. But our friend Hans Kiso from Copenhagen told us. Hans, of course, as a good European, he not only speaks Danish, he also speaks French and German. And he tells us that A Feast Unknown has additional material in the French version that is not present in the English version. In other words, the English version was edited to get out some of the offensive stuff. Now, those of us who've actually read the book said there is more offensive material that was left out. Apparently there was. And one of the things that we're looking at, this is also true for a couple of the other stories that were translated into French. So Hans Kiso is planning to look at that material to see how much extra there was, and he may be giving us a book that contains some of these deleted things that are in the French edition that are not in the American edition. That would be a fascinating book. As you probably know, some people may not know this, but Phil was fluent in French, and he was very well known over there, very well received. I believe he did his own French manuscripts for his books that were published in the French language. And so these additions to that material that we don't have in the English versions, those are probably coming from Phil's hand himself. Now, sometimes translators go in there and they muck around a little bit with the text. I don't think that that happened here. I think that the actual extra material is Phil's own work. So that's another thing we'd like to see. We also do not have a currently available version of the follow-on stories to A Feast Unknown, The Mad Goblin and The Lord of the Trees. Those were the titles that were used in America when this was originally published in 1970. These were follow-on stories to A Feast Unknown involving Doc Caliban and Lord Grunnith, who are the equivalents of a Doc Savage-like character and a Tarzan-like character in Phil's own universe. These are his own characters that he owned entirely. In England, they had republished these in hardbound with different titles, and this was back in the 1980s. I was lucky. Believe it or not, I scored a copy of each of those in a bookstore. This is down like a Walden's bookstore in the used book section, or in the bargain section, I should say. They actually had these two books, and I saw Phil Farmer with titles I did not know. And when I went and I looked at them, I realized what they were. These are hardcover versions of Phil Farmer's stories, which had only been published in paperback here. Those actually, I believe, were also republished around 1980. The originals were an ace double, an ace double flipbook. Later on, they republished them in 1980, and they didn't do the flipbook. They just had the two stories, one after another, in another book. With, I think it also had the title Lord of the Trees or something like that. We haven't had in America, we have not had a hardcover version of that. You know, in all honesty, I would love to see hardcover versions of A Feast Unknown and the other two Caliban and Grunnith books made available to the American market. You know, it would be nice if they could do that also in conjunction with, that's what the Doc Savage biography, but there's also another piece of information that I haven't actually shared with you, which I should. During the weekend, there was discussion about The Monster on Hold. Are you familiar with this at all, Rick? Does that sound familiar?
I've never heard of that.
Okay. In 1983, at, I believe it was like a Northwest sci-fi convention, Phil Farber revealed that he had in process a Doc Caliban novel entitled The Monster on Hold. And in fact, he included in the program of the convention one of the chapters from the middle of the story. And what we know of it, from what I've been told, this story was a sequel, of course, to The Mad Goblin and Lord of the Trees, but it was focusing on Doc Caliban. It did not involve the Tarzan-type character, Lord Grunith. And Phil had intended this to be the third story in this trilogy, with The Feast Unknown coming first. The other two stories, Mad Goblin and Lord of the Trees, really were the same story told in parallel. So I consider them really a second volume. This would be the third volume in the trilogy. And the intention was that this story would be the conclusion of the story of the Nine. The Nine, of course, being the villainous cabal that actually rules the world, and who Grunith and Caliban eventually team up to fight. This is going to be the denouement of that story. It was also intended by Phil Farmer that this would give his explanation for the events that occurred in the very last published Doc Savage story, Up From Earth's Center. Now, Up From Earth's Center is a very unusual story, and it was accidentally the last story in the Doc Savage corpus. It wasn't meant to be, but that's the way it ended up happening because of the vicissitudes of the publishing industry. And very briefly, what goes on in this story is that a man is discovered wandering around in Maine who claims to be a demon who had been alive 200 years before and had been living underground in hell underneath Maine. Doc Savage is in the area for one reason or another, and he comes to investigate the mystery, and eventually he goes down and descends into hidden caverns underneath Maine and encounters strange beings and what appears to be the devil himself. The story is very Dante-esque. You know, another way of saying it sounds a lot like Dante's Inferno with some of the storyline. And in the ending of the story, Doc and his crew escape. The wandering demon fellow is no longer there. He's gone. He went underground and stayed underground. And at the end of the story, there's a question as to whether this story really happened or not. Was this a hallucination? Did the volcanic gases down there cause hallucinations? Was this a real hell? Were these extraterrestrial beings? What was going on? And that's the mystery that we're left with. And that was the end of the Doc Savage corpus. This is in 1949. Well, Phil Farmer, in the Monster on Hold, is planning to give his explanation for what actually happened. And it was his intention thereby to kind of give a close out to the Doc Savage sagas, his version of what he thinks could have been there. And so this book is important for a number of reasons. It is the culmination of the trilogy that starts with The Feast Unknown. It is the last Doc Caliban novel that we know of. And it was intended to postulate an explanation for what actually happened in the story Up From Earth's Center that was the conclusion of the Doc Savage saga. So, you know, in my humble opinion, this story is the holy grail of Phil Farmer's pulp career, his pulp period. Now, from what I understand from my contacts, Phil left behind quite a bit of prose relating to this story, only one section of which he actually revealed 83, but he never finished it. There was some prose, there's some outline material, but there was no completed story, and what is present has not been properly edited and gone through for spelling and redundancy and all that. The boys I know Mike Croteau, Paul Spiteri, Chris Carey, and Wynn Eckert are seriously reviewing this material, and they're going to see if it is possible to complete this material and to give to the world The Monster on Hold. This would be the last of the major Farmer works that had not been completed by Phil before his death. Now, of course, this project is just in its infancy. They don't really have clear clearance to do this yet. They have to check with the heirs and all the rest of it. But I think with the wonderful job that these young men have done, publishing Phil's material, getting it out there, and keeping it present to the world, I think that it would be a marvelous thing to actually get this last major work of Phil's completed and out. Now, we've been waiting for this. It's 28 years, gang. 28 years we've been waiting for somebody to complete this. So, I think that it would be marvelous, absolutely marvelous, if we could get this last great story completed. You know, for me, I consider it the holy grail of Phil's pulp period. And, I would hope that the Farmer File guys would get to go. Yeah, I should backtrack. The four young men we've talked to, in conjunction with other fellows like Art Bowman and John Small and Steve Mattson and a variety of other folks, have put together a magazine called Farmer File, which they started publishing back in 2005. It had eventually 15 issues, which contained a lot of the material about from Phil's work. They also had essays about him. They reprinted the novel, The Bottomless Pit, in installments. Betty Farmer put some articles in talking about living with Phil, which were always very interesting. And the Farmer File magazine, I think, is what demonstrated their seriousness in dealing with the literary legacy of Phil Farmer. And I think that this is what has encouraged Phil and his heirs to let these young men work with that material. I think that the Farmer File is an excellent resource for learning about Phil's work and getting into some depth. They actually let me publish an article in there once, for which I am eternally grateful. I was very honored to do that. That kind of made me one of the folks on the inside. But in any case, The Monster on Hold is, right now, that is the next great project, which will take some time. And as both as a Doc Savage fan and as a Phil Farmer fan, I am really looking forward to seeing this. The two things that they've published that I really, really have been waiting for a long time, The Monster on Hold is one of them that I've been waiting for, and Kwasin Song is the other. Kwasin Song, from what I've read of it, those first two chapters, I really want to see that novel published. I want to see it out there. We also need to get republished the Haddon books, Haddon of Ancient Opar and The Flight from Opar. So, now this is, as you can tell, there was an awful lot of interesting business at this con. I was very privileged to be on the inside. These folks have been very generous in sharing their time and their information with me. I'm hoping that by letting the world know about what's being planned, that we'll be able to garner some support for the completion of these projects. I really want to see that Doc Savage Apocalyptic Life Critical Edition published. I'm hoping against hope that they might be able to even get it into hardback. Same thing on the Bison Tarzan Alive. It would be nice if there was a hardcover version of that too. But in any case, getting the new critical edition of Doc Savage out for the 80th anniversary, that would be marvelous. And getting reprints on these other books from Phil's pulp period and his Will Newton stuff, that also is something I'm really looking forward to.
Okay. Yeah.
Now,
anything else going on at the show?
Oh, yeah. Well, there was tons of stuff. I do want to say we did this FarmerCon in conjunction with Locus. And there was a lot of things going on at the Locus Awards banquet. They presented several different awards to different people. This was their primary reason for having the Locus banquet. Locus, I'll tell you a little bit about Locus magazine. It is about, started out as a fanzine, really, that was published by a fellow named Charles Brown. Mr. Brown loved everything of science fiction and fantasy. He was, very active and, you know, people describe him as being, you know, very knowledgeable and very, a very fun guy to be around. Mr. Brown unfortunately passed away last year after the previous Locus conference. He had been ill, and he actually, from what they told me, he died on the trip back home from the conference. And this is kind of, if you will, it's a good way to go, because Locus started out as a two-sided, one-page mimeographed fanzine, and it has now burgeoned into the magazine for science fiction writers. It's kind of like the trade magazine that all the writers read. They have an online website. The magazine is chock full of lots of information. It concentrates quite a bit on the writers and what they do. And, you know, it fills a gap for me. Way back, I don't know whether you remember back in the early 90s. Do you remember on science fiction, sci-fi, channel, they had something called Sci-Fi Buzz? Do you remember that at all?
Oh, yeah, I remember hearing that.
Yeah, you never saw them, though, did you? You're probably too young.
Yeah.
These kids today. Anyway, a Sci-Fi Buzz was a science fiction news show where they had stories about different science fiction books, movies. They covered fantasy as well. They had a weekly commentary by Harlan Ellison. Harlan was always fun to watch because he's one of the most dyspeptic men in America. But he always had very intelligent and incisive criticisms of things that were going on at that time. And the thing I loved about Sci-Fi Buzz is that they would go to the Hugos and they would show you pictures of people receiving their awards. You see what Larry Niven really looked like. You saw what Connie Willis looked like. You saw all these different people whom you had heard about, whose books you had read, but whom you'd never seen in person unless you went to the cons. And they put it on TV, and it was wonderful. Well, Locus has been doing that same kind of thing. They focus on the writers, and their awards are actually voted on by their readership, which includes a lot of the professionals in the field. They have a larger voting base than either the Hugo or the Nebula. They have a banquet every year, and this banquet was it's actually a luncheon banquet. It was given this past Saturday, and Charles Brown was notorious for wearing these absolutely florid Hawaiian shirts, shorts and sandals everywhere and in every weather. And so the theme for the banquet is always Hawaiian shirts and leis. That's the way. Now, we did not know that. You know, if we have the PharmaCon again in conjunction with the Lotus Award banquets, I will definitely come prepared with a Hawaiian shirt and be appropriately dressed for the conference. But Connie Willis was the MC for the awards, and I think I've spoken with you about Connie before. I'm sure that her name is very familiar to many people in our audience. Connie Willis is probably the most recognized science fiction author, period. She has received more Hugos and Nebulas, I think, than anybody else. Her stories are always intelligently written. They're upbeat. They're funny. They are written definitely from a woman's perspective, but very accessible to the male audience as well. I love her work because it's lighthearted, it's very positive, and it's uplifting. My favorite story of hers is To Say Nothing of the Dog, which is a time travel adventure romance involving a hunt for the Bishop Bird Stump. If you don't know what that is, don't worry. You won't figure it out until about page 60 of the book. They are trying to rebuild the cathedral in, I believe it's Chichester, which was bombed in World War II. And in order to do this, they need to go back and to find different artifacts that were that we know were in the cathedral, but for which we don't have any photographs. Nothing survived. And that's part of the storyline. It is very funny. It is absolutely delightful. You run into some time paradoxes and the great character development. You know, I couldn't put the story down. I was reading it while I was in the National Guard, and we were having our annual training, and it was it just kept me in a good mood the whole time while we were out in the field. I took it with me. But she has her book Doomsday, which was a Hugo Award winner, which is a superb book, also dealing with time travel. There's also the book Bellwether, and she has multiple short stories. She has a wonderful collection of Christmas stories that that I would highly recommend. But I did want to comment that, you know, Ms. Willis was the MC. Not only that, but she was very kind to us PharmaCon folks. She came over and talked with us. You know, when I came into the banquet, you know, she greeted me and she gave me a Hawaiian lei to put on for dinner. And she was extremely hospitable. You know, in many ways, she reminded me somewhat of my Aunt Helen. My Aunt Helen had been the one I've told you about her. She's the one who introduced me to all kinds of TV shows, the James Bond movies, the Doc Savage novels. She was the one who was the inveterate reader, and she was always showing me all these imaginative things, and she's the one that got me into science fiction and into reading. And Connie very much reminded me of her. She's a very sweet lady. She is every bit as much fun and nice as the stories she writes. So, anyway, the awards, there were numerous awards that were given. Probably I should just restrict it to the really big ones. For best science fiction novel, there was the story Bone Shaker by Sherry Priest. Bone Shaker is a steampunk novel in an alternate universe, and it has been very well received. And, you know, that was voted for best novel. The best fantasy novel was The City and the City by China Meagle. People are familiar with China Meagle from Perdido Street and other stories. The City and the City is another very excellent story. Best first novel was Paolo Bacigalupi's The Wind-Up Girl. And the best young adult book was Leviathan by Scott Westerfield. Now, best novella was The Women of Nell Gwynn's by Cage Baker, who was actually at the awards. And then Peter Beagle got best novelette for By Moonlight. Now, Peter Beagle is one of the greats in fantasy. He's been doing this stuff for 50 years. So it was marvelous that he would actually be recognized. And, there were other, the best anthology was The New Space Opera, Volume 2. That was published by HarperCollins. Best collection was The Best of Gene Wolfe. That was published by Tor. And, you know, Gene Wolfe is another, author who's been around for quite some time. I really like his work. Again, very upbeat, very positive. You know, he writes heroic fiction and other stories with good versus evil. I really enjoy his stuff. And there were multiple other, examples. I think there's a book here for best nonfiction book, and it was Cheek by Jowl, which was an autobiographical book by Ursula K. Le Guin. Miss Le Guin was actually there to receive the award, and so we had the opportunity to see her. Anyway, several other awards were also given. If you go to the www.locusmag.com. It will list everything. These stories all are seem very interesting to me, and there are several of these I'm going to be picking up, I think, myself. Of course, I have to have the time to read them. I've decided I'm going to have to either give up eating or sleeping. And probably sleeping is going to have to go by the wayside. Uh-huh. Anyway, now, also in conjunction with this, we went to the Science Fiction Museum. This is actually a small piece that's inside the Rock and Roll Museum there in Seattle at the base of the Space Needle. And this museum has material from books, from movies, a lot of audiovisual stuff. They have things from Corey Ackerman, who had left them stuff. There also are, in the cases, a number of first editions of different novels and stories, some of them going back to people like H.G. Wells. There were at least three different Phil Farmer novels that were included in the various exhibits. And John Small, who is part of the FarmerCon group, he and I, we closed the museum on Saturday. They were shutting the place down with us still inside. So he wanted me to make sure I said, we hung in there. We were the last ones out. The museum is very nice. It has two floors there containing a lot of different material. They have things original from the movies. They have various props from Star Trek, Star Wars, Flash Gordon, a variety of other films, and a lot of things from the history of science fiction. There are films going on with people like Corey Ackerman and Isaac Asimov, and other people telling stories about the early days in science fiction. They also have at the museum a collection not only of books but also of interviews with various science fiction authors that are being preserved. They go into the detail where they talk about their life and their inspiration and what they wrote. Now, part of the museum is what's called the Science Fiction Hall of Fame. This is a recognition for certain writers and individuals who have been involved in the publishing business or in the various media that involve science fiction. There's a large number of these people who have been inducted into the Hall of Fame. There are names that you're going to be familiar with, like Isaac Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke and Robert Heinlein and, of course, Connie Willis. They also have inducted people like Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, and Mary Shelley. Mary Shelley, of course, wrote Frankenstein. There also are some editors and directors of movies. I mean, George Lucas is on there. Interestingly enough, Gene Roddenberry has not been included there in the Science Fiction Hall of Fame. Neither, for that matter, has Phil Farmer. And I think, you can't have everybody on the list, but those are two guys that I think probably should be considered sometime soon. It should be noted that, of course, Phil Farmer has three of his books are scattered there among the exhibits in the Science Fiction Hall of Fame. If you go down to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the Jimi Hendrix exhibit, they used to have a copy of Phil Farmer's novel, The Night of Light, which was a Hugo Award winner. They no longer have the novel out for some reason. I think there was a problem with it, but instead they do have the cover on the wall there in the Jimi Hendrix exhibit, and they have a recording which describes the influence that Phil Farmer's novel, The Night of Light, had on Jimi Hendrix. In fact, in the old Berkeley edition of Night of Light on page 34, Phil Farmer describes the weather at one point in the story and uses the term purple haze. It is that use of the term purple haze that was the inspiration for the album of the same name by Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix acknowledged that the album itself was influenced by the novel and that he named it after this one phrase in A Night of Light. You know, in light of all that, the fact that Phil Farmer is not only recognized in the science fiction part of the museum, but also in the rock part of the museum. Hopefully the folks that do the Hall of Fame will consider him for inclusion sometime in the future. Now, we were privileged to be present at the induction of the four newest members to the Science Fiction Hall of Fame. The first member was Octavia Butler. Octavia Butler was an African-American woman who had written a number of science fiction stories dealing with some social and ecological issues. She was very concerned about the environment. Ms. Butler was taken from us very unfortunately about 4 years ago due to personal illness, and she was cut down really in the prime of her writing. But her work is very highly recognized. She was responsible for setting up scholarships for other individuals interested in the writing craft. She also has some scholarships for African Americans that are part of her legacy. And I could tell there were a lot of people there. There were some of her relatives and other people who had known Octavia, and she was very beloved by these people. And it was a shame that she's gone now, but it is with great pleasure that she is now being recognized at the pinnacle of her field. She's included in the Hall of Fame. Also, at this ceremony, Roger Zelazny was recognized, and he was inducted into the Hall of Fame. Roger Zelazny was known for a variety of works, including The Lord of Light. He also did one of my favorite novels, This Immortal. He was a very imaginative man, and he influenced many people. During the ceremony, they had a brief film by Neil Gaiman, whom some of you may recognize. Neil is a fantasy writer from England, and Neil talked about how Roger Zelazny's work had not only influenced him, but he had gotten the chance to interact with Roger and had been given impetus and encouragement by Roger to do his work, and how he really attributes his current career to the influence of Roger Zelazny. Another person who was inducted is the very famous Richard Matheson. Now, he is somebody who has been active for many years, since the 1950s, in all aspects of science fiction and of adventure fiction writing. He has worked in writing standalone novels and short stories. He's worked in the TV industry. He's worked in the movie industry. Among Mr. Matheson's work, he wrote the original script for The Incredible Shrinking Man. He also wrote the novelette I Am Legend, which has been made into films 3 times. I think that the various films, the one film that I liked that was based on I Am Legend was The Last Man on Earth. Isn't that it?
Yeah, that's the Vincent Price
one. Yeah, the Vincent Price one. Vincent Price plays the lead character, I think that was the best of the three. The others are good in their own right, but they really did not use Matheson's actual material. Richard Matheson's story, I Am Legend, is about the last man on Earth. Everyone else has basically turned into a vampire in the story. And here he is trying to struggle to survive as the last normal human on the planet. It is a story about isolation. It is a story about what it is to be different. It is a story about what civilization is. There are times the story will bring you to tears. It was one of the most moving stories I've ever read, and I highly recommend that. The original story, the movies are fine. Go back to the original. Matheson will make you cry. He's very good. Richard Matheson also did a script. Actually, this started out as a story that was published in Playboy magazine, The Duel, which was about a driver driving across the desert, I believe going from Las Vegas to California, and a psychopathic truck driver. The two of them have a duel basically to the death as he tries to get away from this truck driver, go past him, or whatever. The reason why this story is so important in the history of not only science fiction but of media is because it was made into a TV movie that was directed by a young man by the name of Steven Spielberg.
Now, was that one with Dennis Weaver?
Yes, that's the one. And this was Spielberg's first professional work, and it's because of this job that he got the Jaws job that really made his career. Matheson has done an awful lot in television. I can't even remember all the things that they said he was involved in. But he is another man who has done tremendous amounts of work in this field. I should also mention that he is still with us and still working. He is in his 80s, and he was not well this weekend. He was not able to be with us, but his son came to receive the award in his stead. So Richard Matheson has been presented into the Hall of Fame. The last individual that was inducted into the Hall of Fame was Doug Trumbull. Doug Trumbull may be a name that is not familiar to many of you, but Mr. Trumbull has been working in the special effects business since the late 1960s. He was the man responsible for the special effects in a little movie called 2001: A Space Odyssey. I remember seeing that film in 1968, and the effects in that film were not like anything that had existed before. Nobody had come even close to that. He perfected a number of new techniques in order to give realism to the special effects and to the models that were involved. This was a breakthrough film for a variety of reasons, but I will say that the special effects ran away with the film. There was quite a bit of it, and it was very well done. He also was responsible for the effects in another little movie called Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Mr. Trumbull was also the writer and director of another movie called Silent Running with Bruce Dern. This was another breakthrough film where he was doing special effects work. Silent Running is a cult classic about ecology, and Bruce Dern, crazy old Bruce Dern, is trying to save the last forest in the solar system, which is on a space platform that is circling the planet Saturn. Now, Mr. Trumbull was involved in a number of other films. Are you familiar with the movie Brainwave at all, Rick, with Natalie Wood and Christopher Walken?
I've heard of it. I don't know if I've seen it or not.
Yeah, it goes back. You know, Natalie Wood was alive at the time. So that's 20 years ago. Actually, this movie was being shot around the time that Natalie died. And because she died, they had to cut some of what they had out of the film, and the film ended a little prematurely. But the storyline was interesting. The story in Brainwave was that the scientists had developed a way of recording mental images, and not only recording them, but playing them back in your mind so that you could experience things that other people had done. And Doug Trumbull did a number of innovative things with film. There are a couple of scenes there where he had to have 700 separate film scenes on a single cell. Because of the way they were doing it, the showing the panoply of thoughts in a person's mind as it sweep past. Now the interesting thing is that he did this stuff basically without computer graphic imagery. Nothing that Doug Trumbull does uses computer graphics. Well, not much. These days you can't get away without doing some, but you know, his area is not computer graphics. It is actual optical imagery, and down in Disney, where they in the Epcot Center and out in California, where they have these rides where you're in a simulator and you're immersed in the environment and you're going down the roller coaster and you're going through the town in Back to the Future. That ride was designed by Doug Trumbull, and it involved an innovative camera technique where you actually move through the scenery and you get, you know, full visual imagery going out widely to the side. He has also pioneered in new digital type films running at higher speeds in order to prevent the blurring that occurs with normal film that's running at 24 frames a second. They had a short film at the induction ceremony showing how many of the major science fiction and fantasy films Doug Trumbull has done work on, and the various different patents he's gotten on new technologies in order to make these things work. And his work, I was shocked to see how many of the films I had known and liked very much were Doug Trumbull films. And this was, again, this is stuff that did not involve CGI, but involves rather camera tricks, tricks of perspective, using models, and using advanced electronic camera techniques. So he was the last of the inductees. I should say that at the awards, the MC for the induction ceremony was Greg Bear. Greg Bear is another one of my favorites. He has a novel, Blood Music, which is just, I can't say enough about it. It was an excellent story. It's a story about what happens if the white cells in your blood all of a sudden can be made intelligent and what they would do. Very excellent book from a long time ago, from about 20 years ago. Greg Bear also, as he was talking to us, he talked about his novel, Eon. And Eon is another mind-blowing novel which talks about, the possibilities for singularities and, time and space travel and all this stuff. It was a superb book. And one of the things that he mentioned at the ceremony was that, Charles Brown, who was, a very famous the fellow who actually inducted Locust magazine, he brought to him a copy of his novel Eon and handed it to him. And he asked, well, gee, why are you giving this to me? And Charles Brown said, open the book. He opened the book and saw that it had a book plate on it. This was Robert Heinlein's personal copy of Eon that Charles Brown had gotten from the estate. And he presented it to Greg Bear, and this is something amazing. You are a science fiction writer, and you have a copy of the personal copy of your novel that was owned by the great Robert Heinlein. Amazing stuff. I was able to meet several of the greats in science fiction. I've already mentioned Connie Willis. We've got Greg Bear there. But they also had Nancy Kress. We had Gardner Dozier was there. Ursula K. Le Guin was there. Michael Bishop, another author whom I've really enjoyed over the last 20 years or so. And just a host of these folks. And they were very wonderful people. They were happy to have fans there and to share this time with us. They took their time to come and talk to us. We talked a little about Phil Farmer with them. And a good time was had by all. Now, there's one other thing I wanted to mention. In conjunction with PharmerCon, a new book has been published, The Worlds of Philip Jose Farmer, Protean Dimensions. This is a book that includes some fiction pieces, some nonfiction pieces, and some unpublished material by Phil himself that's come out of the Magic Filing Cabinet. The collection was edited by Mike Croteau, and it includes stories and essays by David Bishop, Wynne Eckert, Randall Garrett, James Gunn, Rhys Hughes, Chris Roberson, and several others. Dennis Powers is also included. Dennis is somebody known to us here in the St. Louis community. He's one of our local guys who's very into the pulp hero stuff. This is a wonderful collection. It has an introduction that's done by Paul Malmont. Paul Malmont is a friend of the show. We've had him on before. Paul wrote the wonderful novel, Chinatown Death Cloud Peril. I always stumble over that. Chinatown Death Cloud Peril, which is a story really about the pulp writers, Lester Dent, Walter Gibson, L. Ron Hubbard, E. E. Smith, and a variety of others. It's a fun story. He's going to have a sequel of that being published very shortly, which is going to involve some of those characters and others. I highly recommend Paul's work. Well, anyway, Paul did an introduction to this this collection, and it was an introduction that made my heart thump, because he talks about how when he was growing up, he loved the pulp characters, the Shadow, Doc Savage, all of those guys, but he felt so alone. He seemed like he was the only one who knew or cared about it, and how the internet had brought him into contact with so many other people who had interest in this area and who loved the same things he did. And, how that being able to join into a community of people who love these characters and who love pulp meant so much to him. It was a very moving essay that we have. It's the opening introduction to this book, The Worlds of Philip Jose Farmer. This book is actually available through pjfarmer.com. Mike Croteau is the owner of the website, pjfarmer.com. He also is the editor of the book. Anybody who's interested in getting a copy, by all means, head on out to www.pjfarmer.com/4th.htm, or just go to the main page at pjfarmer.com. They have a little window which will get you down there so you can order it. Good book, highly recommended. It's got essays in it by many different important characters and new stories. By all means, get this book. I'm reading through it now myself, and it's very enjoyable. I really have enjoyed Paul's introduction. As I said, really moved me. And that's what I did with my weekend.
Well, that's a quiet weekend, huh?
Yes, indeed. I have to say, these folks were very wonderful. I'm an old handicapped guy who walks with a cane, and they hung in there with me. We walked up to the Space Needle. We walked through the museum. We just had a good time, and I feel very privileged and honored to be included with this group of people. The PharmaCon guys have been wonderful. They've shared, what they've done with Phil. They've shared a lot of things with me. We also had, I should mention a couple of other names that we had with us. We had Henry Franke III, who is the auditor of the Jules Verne Society, and he's also editor of the Jules Verne Society magazine. Let me make sure I get everybody in. He also does the Burroughs Bibliophile on Facebook. He's very interested in networking with people who like Burroughs. Henry is extremely knowledgeable on Edgar Rice Burroughs and on the publishing end of it. He's a collector of the artwork. He knows what the critical editions are. If you got any questions about Edgar Rice Burroughs material, Henry Franke is the man you want to talk to. John Small, whom I've mentioned before, works for the newspaper down in Oklahoma. He has a magazine, a little literary magazine that he published called Glimmer Glass. Volume 1 is out, and he's looking at trying to do Volume 2 for next year. I was actually a contributor to that volume, but it's a fine little magazine. It has some fun stories in it, and I'd highly recommend that you check it out. Glimmer Glass, one word is the title of it. Just go ahead and search for it on Google. Wim Eckert is the author of the Pemberley House story that was published by Subterranean. This was a story that he and Phil collaborated on before Phil passed away. It was based on notes and on actual material that Phil had done back in the 1970s, but which never saw the light of day. I think that we also have Chris Carey, who was doing Song of Kwasan, which hopefully will be published. I really am looking forward to that volume. I really enjoyed those Haddon and Opar stories by Phil, and I hope that those are going to get reprinted too. I should mention that Chris's wife, Laura, was there. She also works in publishing. She actually works over at the University Bookstore there in Seattle. That University Bookstore is the place to go for science fiction in Seattle. They have all kinds of signed books, signed by the original authors. If you want to get a first edition that's signed or any edition that's signed, that's the place to go, is the University Bookstore in Seattle. She also contributed an article to the Worlds of Philip Jose Farmer collection here, and it was entitled "It Could Make a Great Fantasy." She's a very lovely and intelligent lady, and we were so happy to have her there. We normally are just graced with Chris, but since he lives generally in that location, he was able to bring Laura along with him, so that was great. And then, of course, we've got Henry Kiso and his wife Hani, who have come from Denmark for all of the Farmer Cons. They work it in as their vacation. They are very lovely people. I always enjoy talking with them because they're very knowledgeable about things in Europe, books in Europe, and things of this type. The only other person who's as knowledgeable, I think, as Henry is our friend Jean-Marc Letissier, who's another one we need to get back on the show, talk about French comics.
Exactly.
Yeah. But anyway, this is a great group of people. Mike Croteau, of course, was there with his family. His kids are growing up, my gosh. And, of course, Paul Spiteri. Paul was not able to bring his family this year. He has a lovely wife and two beautiful little girls who probably aren't little anymore. And last time I saw them was 2 years ago. Everybody's growing fast. It's like my family. They're all growing too fast. But it's always a pleasure to be there and to see Paul come all the way from merry old England to be with us. And as I said, that's pretty much what we did for the holiday. If anybody does get the chance to go to the Locus Magazine Awards ceremony, they had a number of talks, they had some workshops, they had all these different folks. You know, Connie Willis is there, and Nancy Kress, and Mike Bishop, and Ursula K. Le Guin. You can actually go and meet and interact with some of your favorite authors. They were very, very generous to us. They were very kind in sharing their time and space with us, and you know, they actually came over and made us welcome, and I'm very thankful for that. And that's pretty much it.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you had a really fun time there. So.
Really did. It was a wonderful conference, and I hope that, you know, right now we're not sure what we're going to do with PharmaCon next year. Farmer's family would like to have something down in Peoria next year, but we had such a good time here with the Locust folks. We're wondering if, you know, we might not come back. If we don't come back next year, we may do it the year after that.
Now, is PharmaCon by invite or?
PharmaCon is, yeah, it's pretty much by invite. I was very lucky. I'm kind of local, and I kind of, you know, got to know these guys, and I was invited to come in. I think that I don't know what the plans are exactly for next year. I think, though, that they do have I think there are some reservations that are open. Originally it was pretty much a restricted group, but I think now they pretty much are having open invitations. You know, people can write in and say they want to come. And as I said, this is a friendly group of guys and gals. You know, we love folks who love Phil Farmer. I should stipulate. There's one guy I forgot to mention. Stu Schiffman was also there. He was part of the Farmer group. Stu Schiffman is a local up there in Washington State. He's a Sherlockian, and he has contributed to the Wall Newton stuff quite a bit. Stu was an interesting fellow. He apparently is from the New York area originally, like I am. And we talked a little bit about that, and he actually had me give him a signed volume of my son Coast Stories. He's interested to see how I handled the character, but the PharmerCon is open on. I'm looking at here. It is really open to the fans of Phil Farmer. if you're interested in coming, if anybody's interested in coming, you can go over to the pjfarmer.com, and it's www.pjfarmer.com, and there will be con information. Anybody interested in coming, I'm sure that they'd love to have you. And we'll, you know, we always have a good time going there. This is a fun thing. It's, you know, it's another thing that fans are doing for other fans. And these guys are really serious about getting Phil's work and bringing it out to the public.
Okay. Well, thanks for updating us on this.
It was my pleasure. As always, you probably noticed that if you just throw me a soapbox, it's all over.
Yeah, and once in a while you might hear me comment.
Yeah, yeah, you came in there a couple of times. That was good. Slow me down a little. But, I should say that Volume 2 of Crossovers has just been published, which is Win Eckert's book, where he goes through the Walt Newton universe and shows all the crossovers between different characters throughout history and throughout literature. And Win is very interested in coming on the show and talking about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Also, Chris Carey said that, you know, as soon as the plans are finalized for Song of Kwasin, so you can talk openly about all this stuff, he wants to come on too.
Okay.
So those are two more shows that we got in the works.
And let's not forget about our July book of the month. Yeah, which is, well, I can get it out here, so I won't mess up the title.
Okay.
The Jim Anthony Super Detective. The Hunters, first volume, you know, the volume two.
Right.
With Josh Reynolds and Micah S. Harris.
Ah, yes. Micah Harris, who had done the Becky Sharp story.
And this is an Airship 27 production.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, Airship 27 has got some more stuff coming out. They're going to have a Green Llama novel by Abel Garcia is coming out pretty soon. And I think Andrew Salmon has got a Black Bat anthology, a couple of stories. Is that out? Is that out yet?
Yeah, I got the flyer.
Okay, great.
I got the thing in the mail.
Yeah, those are going to be. I know that the Green Llama novel is in the works and should be out shortly. We should get Andy Salmon stuff, and you know they have also expressed interest in coming on the show, so we should get them in here and have them chat with us.
Yeah, I got a flyer in the mail yesterday along with a bookmark, which is super cool. I'm already using it.
Super.
And the thing is that it's going to be four short stories in it. And you're going to have, Andy and Aaron Smith, Martin Justice, and, well, Frank, I don't want to mispronounce your last name. I'll let Art do that.
Okay. I don't have it in front of me, so.
Okay, S-C-H-I-L-D-I-N-E-R.
Schindler.
Okay.
Sounds like.
And it's going to be a, you know, Black Bat who, similar to the Batman, you know, kind of a combination of Batman and Marvel's Daredevil.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the same Black Bat character, I believe, that Tom Johnson also had in his detective anthology, okay. Isn't it?
Yeah, it's a Tony Quinn.
Yeah,
attorney who actually can see.
Yeah, now, the interesting thing about the Black Bat character is that he actually continued all the way through to the mid-1950s. He remained rather popular. He started out in the late 30s, I think.
I'll say right here, it ran for 62 issues from July 1939
right.
to winter of 1953.
There you go. So, you know, right to the year I was born. Holy cow. Which was a little while ago, not that long.
Yeah, it's about 7 years before I was born.
And the Black Bat was a very popular character, and hopefully, we'll get some resurrected interest in him. But that's wonderful. We look forward to reading that, and you know, the other thing I ought to mention is just before I came out here, my copy of the Captain Midnight Chronicles from Moonstone was published. And that it's got a story in it by Win Eckert, Captain Midnight at Ultima Thule. which I understand is going to have some interesting things in it. That's critically important. I should say that I believe that Win Eckert's contribution to the worlds of Philip Jose Farmer is also going to contain some very interesting Will Newton information that folks are going to want to be know about. So by all means, if you're a Will Newton fanatic, Worlds of Philip Jose Farmer, you should pick it up.
Okay. I guess we got a lot of stuff for people.
Absolutely. And the whole thing is, we are very blessed at this point in time that pulp is coming back. It is people who have been interested in it are publishing. They're writing in the genre, and we're really looking forward to having more good material. We're not only are we getting a reprinting of the old material, which was great stuff in its day and now, but we're also getting new pulp being written in the same way, and some of it with modern concerns, modern sensibilities. I think that only improves it.
Exactly. I mean, now we're lucky. I mean, since we started the Book Cave here, we've had so many people wanting to come on that I never would have dreamed it'd be as popular as it is.
Well, you know, I think it serves the need. You know, it's, you know, like Paul Malmont said in that introduction that he had to Worlds of Philip Jose Farmer. You know, a lot of us have been impassioned about this stuff. I was impassioned about this stuff back in the 1960s, and I felt utterly alone. I couldn't find anybody else who was really interested in this, you know, other than Anne Helen. And, you know, after a while, when you can actually meet other people who are into it, who really love the genre, and who have also felt alone, that now you can share it with, it's just wonderful.
Exactly. Well, before we could keep on going on and make this too much of a marathon,
right,
you might want to just go ahead and, you know, close up so people can get ready for the next week's episode, you're going to really enjoy next week. Okay. That's all I'm going to say. I'm going to keep it a surprise. You're going to enjoy who's going to be on and the episode itself. So that just makes you want to go and say, what's going to happen?
There you go.
So that way, if, you know, for some reason it didn't happen, we get somebody else, and hey, that was our plan.
Yeah. We planned that, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess then we'll go ahead and sign off. This is Art Cippo.
And Rick Croxton.
And you are leaving the Book Cave. Have a wonderful week. We'll be seeing you.
Bye-bye.